For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. I'm very happy to have as our guest teacher tonight Paul Disco, who was a disciple priest of Shinryu Suzuki Roshi, founder of San Francisco Zen Center, and is a teacher in our lineage, and was sent by Suzuki Roshi to study in Japan for 5 years to study temple carpentry and design, and has, since he returned to the West, built many temples and temple buildings and homes and in the Japanese style in California, in Japan, and in Europe, and in other places in America. And we'll talk tonight about Japanese style of Zen training and American training and other related aspects of Zen and other things. So, Paul, thank you very much for being here.
Good evening. I would like to talk to you about something that has been a question for me for a long time. And I've been here for several days now. I've met a fair number of you and deeply impressed with the group of rather mature, sensible people, which you don't always find in Zen centers, I must have to admit. It has a tendency to draw a few people with more ideas that are floating higher in the sky, anyway, shall we say. I met Suzuki Roshi kind of by accident and became quite enamored of his style and became quite a devoted student of his. And I was actually on my way to Japan, and he talked me out of it. Didn't exactly talk me out of it. He just suggested that I might have another path. And when I agreed with him, he ordained me. And shortly after, he sent me to Japan to study temple building. So that was a teaching unto itself right there for me. And I think it's one that plays into what I'm going to try to talk about tonight. Anyway, I went to Japan, and I grew up in a counterculture family in Berkeley, California. I never really sort of fit into everyday bourgeois culture as is found in most American cities. And when I got to Japan, I felt like I'd gone home. I felt the way they did things, the way they designed things. I used to be kind of alienated in high school, and I would sit in the back of the class and sketch various things. And when I got to Japan, I found that they'd built those things that I'd sketched in my sketchbook, and they'd already been there. Anyway, so I felt very much at home when I was there. And I was learning new things constantly, and I was very open to the experience. And since I'd been in a very Japanese environment for 4 years, I kind of knew my way around the body language, the Japanese body language, even if I didn't have the verbal language down very strongly. And since Japan is not a verbal culture, and so much is done with body language and and nonverbal communication, that it was fairly easy to fit in. The Japanese are very sensitive. Since they lost the war to Americans, they're very sensitive about whether or not we like them, or whether or not we think they're you know, they're worthy or not. So if they sense that you like them, they're very opening. I found them very embracing, and very generous. But I kind of drank the Kool-Aid. I kind of went whole hog, and lived in a thatched roof house with a well in the kitchen and a wood-fired clay stove, and grew my own vegetables in a vegetable garden across the street, and carefully separated my feces and urine in my outhouse so I could use them to fertilize the plants separately because you use them differently. And anyway, I regressed a few centuries up there, and enjoyed it greatly. And I was also working. I was also working with people that were also from another century, really. The class of people that do construction work, or especially this kind of construction work, are called shokunin, which means workmen, basically. Shoku is work and nin is person, but it means more than that. It means, I don't know, some of you have seen that movie Jiro Dreams of Sushi. That was the theme of that movie. It's a kind of a dedication to craft. It's a kind of dedication to craft that takes precedent over almost everything. Anyway, so I went deeply into that world, and I also, because I was in Kyoto and there was no Soto Zen in Kyoto, or none appropriate Soto Zen in Kyoto, shall I say, I studied at a Rinzai temple in Daitokuji with a man named Nanrei Komori, and it was quite a grand temple. It was the garden was a national treasure, and one of the buildings was a national treasure. The buildings where we sat zazen was a national treasure. It's called Mitan was the name of the building, and it was it was a very special building. And Buddhism in Japan has sort of a mixed lineage. It was the people that kept the records of all the family records, so that they were, and so that since the class structure in Japan is so thick and so heavy, they were the ones that kind of enforced the class separation. So if a young couple fell in love and they were from the wrong class, the family would go to the temple to find out what their background was, and they would not be allowed to marry if they weren't properly aligned. Well, it's mostly all arranged marriages anyway. That would all be happened beforehand. But even if they managed somehow to do a Romeo and Juliet, it would be denied. So it was that part of that. I hung out with priests, shokunin, and farmers, and that all very conservative, very old school Japanese life. The business people and the shopkeepers and the academics, I didn't have much contact with academics either. We're more outward looking, more modern. We're not so much that way. But these people were very much old school. Anyway, the one thing that became very clear was that that discipline was very important, and concentration, and the concentration that discipline brings up was very important, even among just ordinary people. The level of even young men would compete to see who could concentrate the deepest. So the level of the level of concentration was sort of a badge of honor. And that concentration came out of a serious practice in whatever field they were in. But for example, when I was there, it was the craze to, in the evening when your headlights were on in the wintertime, and you came to a red light, everybody turned their headlights out. And then when the light turned green, they put them all back on again and took off. So I asked people, well, why do you do that? You know, car's not, you know, why do you turn it? Oh, we're saving the battery or this. They came up with all kinds of silly reasons. But the reason, I finally figured out the reason was it gave them one more thing to do, to participate with life. So just like the tea ceremony is a three-year study to learn how to take an hour and a half to make a cup of tea. So it's, by American standards, it's a little silly. But it's considered very honorific status. It's a status thing. Anyway, Buddhism and Zen in particular is based on a similar kind of training that craft or tea ceremony is, but on a realm that has no form. And the entry to it, of course, is meditation, is Zazen, is the main entry. But on top of that is the teaching. And the teaching basically comes down to form is emptiness, emptiness is form, form is form, and emptiness is emptiness. And so the training, the Zen training, is based on that, on those five. For some reason, it's illegal to say stages. It's forbidden to talk about stages, but they're stages, just the same, and you go through them. You go through them not necessarily in a particular order, depending on the teacher, and different emphasis on different parts, depending on who you are. But one of those stages is that form is emptiness is symbolized by the swastika turning backwards. And that means going against the current of the world. So normally we think, you know, Zen has a very strange reputation in America, and even among dedicated Zen students, they have some rather bizarre concepts. But anyway, the one that gets me the most is this idea of Zen slow. That people do things, sometimes you'll find people doing, especially newer students working in, you know, a Zen bakery or something, do things incredibly slow and carefully as if it was somehow mindfulness. Where in Japan, it's like, who can do it the fastest? It's like, bam! But you can't be, you know, I was being interviewed by a real estate agent to say something about a house that I built that's being sold, and they wanted me to say something cute and light about harmony and peace and that kind of thing. I said, you want a Zen statement? I said, how about hesitate and you die? Now there's a Zen statement for you. Anyway, it's the idea about peace and love and moving very slowly has somehow gotten associated with Zen, which is the farthest thing in the world from what it is in Japan. Anyway, at some point in your training, and it's a large part of your early training in Japan, you must turn against the world. So basically, what that means is, whatever you want, you can't have it. So whatever you want, the teacher's going to say no. And even if it's something good or something that you already have, or it doesn't matter. It's still no. And you're going to be asked to do things that you really don't want to do. And you're going to come across things that where you would rather be taking a nap somewhere than doing. I mean, Zen is basically about freedom. But in order to experience freedom, you have to be free to not do things as well as to do things. So your desires and your aspirations keep you from being free because you are caught by them. And so the teacher that knows you well and works with you will find whatever it is that you're attached to and tell you you can't have it. And in America we have a Judeo-Christian background, and we have this idea of morality. And morality paints things as good and bad as if they last forever, like that, as if this is a good thing forever if it's good. But in Japan, that kind of morality only lasts for an instant. So things may be good this moment and bad the next. So we get very caught up in the idea that if we're told no, that somehow we're a bad person, that we're being scolded. Or if we're told no, that it's going to be that way forever. The classical Rinzai training is they eat millet, which is pretty low on the totem pole of food substances, twice a day for a month. And then they're taken out to a parishioner's house and forced to eat more than they ever could possibly eat, with rich food and noodles and, you know, anyway, they do that until the point where eating or not is not an important matter. And they sit outside in the snow, where the snow, you know, cold or not is not an important matter. They sit in the hot sun, the heat being hot or not is not an important matter. Now that's the Rinzai style, and it's the negative side of that is that people build up a certain amount of arrogance and self-importance that is a little irritating. But that's the classical Zen training. Soto Zen is much more nurturing and much more emphasis on being the same as everyone. Soto Zen in Japan is much more like Shin Zen, Pure Land Buddhism, where the emphasis is being a white bird in the snow, not to stand out, not to be different, not to be special. Suzuki Roshi was a great example of that. But at the same time, he could be quite strict on us in little bursts. It was hard on him. He tried to bring in other teachers to make that. He felt it was something lacking in his, that he couldn't be stricter on us. He felt was something lacking in our training. But being Americans, it's hard to be repressed in this culture without taking it personally. So therefore, he was a very good teacher especially for that time and those students, because he let us come along slowly at our own pace and in our own way. But to understand Zen and really to be free in that sense, you have to understand that you alone are the great anointed one. You are. If you say that you're Jesus Christ in this culture, they come and take you away. If you say you're Buddha in this culture, they say, "Oh, very good, thank you." In Japan, you know, you have to see yourself as the world itself, and as no different from the world itself. So it includes everybody else and the trees and the birds and the rocks. And to have that kind of freedom, you have to be in a state where you don't You don't separate yourself from what's happening in the moment. You don't say, oh, I wish I had a pancake now instead of, you know, instead of cornflakes. You have to say that it's cold out or it's hot and sticky out now, and that's, you know, the best of all possible worlds. But how to teach, how to be a teacher in this realm, and to work with people, and have them be discouraged, not get personally discouraged, having them be the channeled into a narrow path when they want to run wild is something that's kind of un-American and difficult for Americans in general to come to terms with, and it's difficult for teachers in America to experience. In the craft world, in Japan, if somebody wants to be, say, a potter, for example, they say, fine, make a teacup, and then you struggle for a while, and you finally make a teacup that is to the teacher's liking. And then the teacher says, oh, that's very good. Now make 10,000 of them and have them done by next week. So you can't do that to Westerners. They won't stand for it. Maybe they won't. That's too much. It's overwhelming. I didn't know about a German pottery teacher that had people throw things all day, and then she would come and look at them and pick them apart and smash them all and have them do something else the next day. But that's the Germans and the Japanese have a very similar understanding about how humans should live. Anyway, in my work practice, because I'm doing it as a business, I can't be that strict on people. I have a different relationship to them. I'm not in their personal life. I'm paying them, and I have to figure out how to challenge them and have them reach just a little bit farther than they're used to reaching, so that they're learning and keeping engaged and keeping excited, but not transcending, just growing, which is very important. It's very important to grow, but it's also important to be able to not grow, to be able to not be caught by your innermost desires. When I was doing the carpentry projects, when I had the carpentry crew at Green Gulch, which I did for a number of years, we meditated together and we ate together and we worked together and we had rooms on site and were paid minimally. The money was just for toothpaste and, you know, a weekend beer or something. It wasn't a living wage, because we're getting room and board, and there, under those circumstances, you could have somebody do something that was way over their head, and that they had to really stretch to do, and if they failed, it was okay because they could do it again. And you didn't have to worry about failure. Was sort of a positive a positive aspect. You and Suzuki Roshi used to talk constantly about failure being important. So that since time and money was not connected to each other, failure was a very good teaching device. And failure, you didn't take it personally. I mean, it's like if you're trying to pole vault and you knock the bar down, you don't say, "Oh, I'm a bad person. I must have sinned in my previous life." You know, you just say, "Oh, I've got to practice more." That kind of failure is very instructive, and it also is encouraging. It's also humbling as well. Well, that's not quite the same as being denied the things that you want to do. In Japan, it was just, anyway, I was engaged in the environment, so whatever the teacher said, and with Suzuki Roshi also, I just said yes. And I felt no separation there was never any second thoughts. I just said yes because it's a special environment and it's sort of outside of life. It's happening in another realm, and it's easy to just say yes because you're in this sort of special realm. It's not like you're with your peers and with your in your society, where there are your hopes and fears of how you're going to progress in society is all caught up with your sense of yourself. In Japan, I was an alien. I was good enough to be considered, especially out in the country where the people weren't very sophisticated, they considered me Japanese. Just really spastic, that didn't move very well, and really ignorant because I couldn't speak very well, and just really a cripple, basically a mental and physical cripple, but Japanese. I appreciated that and I enjoyed that. But when I got back to Green Gulch after Japan, well, number one, I had to deal with reentry, which was extremely difficult because Americans move so slow and they do so many stupid things and they waste so much stuff. And compared to Japan, where everything moves so quickly and so effortlessly, the hour opens up. There's more minutes in the hour in Japan than there is in San Francisco. The day opens up and you can get twice as much done in the day. And as I was saying that talking before about Tatsuyami Roshi teaching his idea of teaching Dogen was to say, get on the railroad tracks of Dogen Zenji's way, which is very, very much what Zen has come down to now in this day and age in Japan, where it's a form, it's a ritual, there's a path that you don't have to decide about. Railroad tracks, the engineer only gets to apply the speed, he doesn't get a chance to steer left and right. So that's in Japan, Zen and Japanese life in general is on railroad tracks, which is far more efficient than off-road vehicles that our life is on. But on the other hand, it's very rigid and everything is preordained, basically. And that's why Suzuki was so enamored of fighting these people that didn't have it all figured out yet. They had a mind that was untutored by what they were supposed to do next. And so he found this very refreshing, and that beginner's mind is why the book that he found is named that. And it was because he was, for him, the people that just did things because they were supposed to was missing the point, even though they did them perfectly and were, you know, had all the right attributes and then developed the proper concentration, and they didn't choose to do it. They didn't have any choice. They were just doing it because they were trained, culturally trained to do that. Where Americans were choosing to do this. They were exploring it, examining it, looking at it, thinking about it, deciding about it, and actually trying to figure out what it was all about. Where the Japanese already knew what it was about, they didn't have to do it. On Thursday night I was here, and Matt here was reading from Beginner's Mind, and he read us a section on ash is ash, firewood is firewood, of what is the title of that section? Matt? No trace. And I realized that I reread it, because I realized that no trace is something the Japanese do automatically. I was telling somebody today about this woman that lived upstairs in the house where I was staying, and she could come downstairs and walk through the room and go to the bathroom on the opposite side, and you didn't see her do it. She was invisible. But she would, because she left no trace. And that's something that certainly classical and even everyday Japanese are capable of doing. They live in a very crowded society, crowded environment. They can walk on the street with thousands of people and be totally alone. And they leave each other alone. It's totally un-American. I mean, that's just, you know, we go down the street, you know, screaming, here I am, you know. We're very gregarious and outgoing and not all about pulling our energy in. And there's a good side to no trace and a problem side to no trace. But it's something that you definitely, if you're going to be free, you have to know how to do no trace. But it doesn't mean that no trace is a good, that it's a moral value, that no trace is better than something else, or that you have to do it all the time, or that it is the true understanding, or none of that is necessary. But what is necessary is that you have to be able to do it. You have to be able to pull yourself in a way that you leave no trace. That if you're interested in freedom. It's just as hard, it's just to be hard to be caught by things that you want as it is to be caught by things that you don't want. The freedom to do things is wonderful, but the freedom to not do things is also wonderful. And this is something that is the heart of Zen training, but something that's very difficult to teach people, because the teacher has to, it's something that you can't see for yourself, you're too close, you can't see yourself that closely, and the teacher's role is to put you in a position where you either rub up against it and have to see it, or they put you in a position where what it is that you're fixated on can't happen, and you rub up against the inability to be satisfied, and you have to come to terms with that and figure out what that's all about. But we're not big on putting our life in the hands of somebody else. And if we really like somebody, if we're in love with someone, or we're really enthusiastic about a teaching, we can do it for a period of time maybe, but really, it's better if your teacher is somebody you really don't like. Because that makes the teaching all the stronger. If you're doing it because you like them, or you think they're going to smile at you, or like you back, or be, you know, that you're going to get some sort of reward for following their teaching, it's kind of loses its weight. But if somebody tells you to do something, I had the experience in Japan. The first teacher I worked with was a man named Kimura, and he was fairly sophisticated and outgoing, and he had actually been out of the country once. He had been to Hawaii, and so he had a bigger view, and he kind of knew that foreigners were different, and when I worked for him, I was taught nothing. They would not teach me anything, and they would come and watch me do stuff. They say, "Oh, that's very difficult, isn't it?" "Oh, yes, yes." But they wouldn't say how to not be difficult. They wouldn't tell me what I was doing wrong. I had to figure out. I had to watch them. I had to try and try and try and fail and fail and fail and figure it out for myself, which is a good way to learn. But it only goes so far. And then then he ran out of work. We built a rather beautiful temple in northern Kyoto, all out of spruce wood from Canada, Sitka spruce. The whole building was Sitka spruce. It was quite a nice little building. It was a Nichiren temple. Nichiren is the Lotus Sutra, Nam-myoho Renge Kyo. But it was overlaid with Taoism, popular Taoism, so that the god of Daikokuten, the god of wealth, was the name of the temple and the name of the spirit there. And people would bring their cars and their babies and their hi-fi systems and whatever to the temple to have them chant the 12th chapter of the Lotus Sutra over it at the breakneck speed. The priest was quite a performer. Anyway, I digress. After that project was done, he sent me out to the Shika Ken, out to Lake Biwa area, into the country where this war, to a place where they'd never met a foreigner before face to face. They'd seen him on TV and movies, but they'd never actually met one. So they were the ones that thought that I was just a stupid, crippled Japanese. And he told me everything, whether I knew it or not. And he would come. You could hear him. You could hear him coming across the shop floor, because he was the only one that wore leather-soled shoes. Everybody else had rubber-soled shoes. And he would start yelling, "Akan, Akan, Zita, Akan," which is dialect for you're doing it all wrong. get up and get up so I can show you how to do it the right way. And after a while, I sort of learned the drill. When I heard him coming, I made sure my tools were laid out exactly the way you wanted them. My posture was just so, and I had the piece of wood in the right place. And it didn't take me too long to figure out what was expected. But it didn't matter whether I was doing it right or not. He wanted to scold me and show me the right way. And one time when I got up, I was getting up, and he kicked me in the ass. And he was like, not very big. And I was a lot bigger, and I came very close to sending him sprawling. But anyway, every once in a while I would lose it. I would get my American spirit would rise up. One time I had a little funky car, and in Japan, the car that's the most expensive has the right of way. And at that time in Japan, for sure. And I had been waiting in this line of traffic to go over a bridge for blocks, and had been slowly creeping. And it was a big street with two lanes going over the bridge and two lanes alongside that went underneath the bridge, and nobody wanted to go there. They all wanted to go over the bridge, so it was all clear. And this big limousine, you know, Yakuza car comes roaring up and cuts in front of me, thinking that I'm just this little funky Subaru that he can bully. But I wasn't. I was this American with American pride, and I just kept driving. And pretty soon, my bumper was going into his door panel, and when it crunched, he got like how dare I? And he looked over, and I was going, "Oh, motherfucker!" through the windshield. His face dropped, and he spun the wheel and hit the gas, spun out of this shot away. I mean, it was just the idea that anybody would challenge him, and then that it was a foreigner, was just way too. I broke all the rules. I enjoyed doing this. Another time, a little narrow street, there was two cars could pass, but they put the telephone poles, the electric power poles, in the middle, inside the curb of the street, so that two cars couldn't pass where there was a pole. And then they had a water gutter there, so you couldn't drive on the shoulder. And I was driving to work one day in my little beat-up car, and this kid in a very hot, fancy car came driving up behind me and blinking his lights and honking. I just ripped on the emergency brake and got out and asked him very politely, "Are you in a hurry to go somewhere?" Oh, like, my Japanese was good enough to make fun of him by that time. Anyway, but mostly I kept my cool most of the time, especially with my teachers, except for that Hirazawa-san. He was difficult, but he was a good teacher. I learned a lot from him. I mean, he made us all take the National Carpenter's Test, and we would have to practice for 2 hours after work every day. After working 10 hours, we would practice the test for 3 months. We did this, and then we worked Saturday, and then but Sunday. So instead of going home Sunday, I had to stay and take a mock test on Sunday for months, some 2 or 3 months. And anyway, it was extremely good training, but it was not easy. Anyway, I don't know whether I've exposed my dilemma or not, but I would like to know what you people think about how to bridge this gap between the severity, but the intensity of teaching in the East, as opposed to our need to be given a little more respect and space here in the United States. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about social action. I have some ideas about that too, but I'm not sure that it's similar but different. Anyway, please, I would like to hear from you anything that you have to say.
Well, I was hoping that you would have the answer, actually, because I've thought about this for a long time. It is very difficult to set up a situation in which we agree to give up our personal preferences and agree to... I think what you're talking about, there's a very American feeling that we have to believe in what we're doing and we have to like what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And I know that Zen really sort of flies in the face of that, and it's I've often felt that in Sesshin, you know, you can sort of agree that, like, okay, I'm going to give up my personal preferences for this time period. But I don't know that it's always so explicit, and it's not always so conducive to welcoming people into our sangha. You know,
if you're not prepared for it and you have no background for it, it's a hard thing to come up against.
Yeah, I think you know, sometimes just even having it be part of the culture of being in a Zen center, that some of what we do is we give up our personal preferences a little bit, you know, maybe see if you can give up a little bit more. But there's also the danger of giving up your preferences so much that you go overboard and then you just want to just get out. And so it's really a delicate balance.
It is delicate. And then some people psychologically are, I mean, I haven't seen anybody here like that, but in San Francisco and over the years, people would come because they don't trust themselves and they want to be told what to do and they want to you know, cave in to just doing to being told what, you know, what to do. They underplay, which is just as much of a problem, and they have to be encouraged to think it, be daring and try things they've never tried before. Anyway, it's. I mean, a large part of what Zen is about is no. I always, so people that don't really know too much about it, they ask what Zen is. I say, well, just think about writing with a pencil. Now turn the pencil around and think about writing with an eraser. That's the Zen part. You know. So whatever, you know, it's active, it's energetic, but it leaves no trace. But to translate that into everyday life is a hard thing to get across. Yes.
Sort of related to this, I mean, you've been talking about this in terms of the sort of basically different cultures in Japan and the United States, which is clearly part of the background. There's this other aspect of it, this different model of practice that relates to this. And, you know, as Suzuki Roshi said, it's neither monks nor lay people. So already there's this in this culture, there's this sort of built-in conflict because you're navigating between the restraint, being told no, and so on. And at the same time, you're not stepping out. I mean, most people here are going to work. They have families. It's a very different sort of situation than a young Japanese priest to be or craftsman to be would find themselves in. So, you know, I don't know if that really changes the question, but it kind of shifts the.
Actually, I don't think it does shift at all because you're still. It's easier if you're in a cloistered environment, but you still have to face everyday life, and you still have to relate to your teacher, and it's not like you can sort of have, you know, Zen light because you're working out in the big world all the day. You're still coming up, and then often your supervisor or your significant other or your children can also be great teachers. You can take them on as teachers too. And that's maybe a way that's less abrasive, although maybe your supervisor might be abrasive, but you know, somebody that you care about, like a significant other or a child, and then you listen to what they need rather than what you need, and relate to them that way. I think that's a very good practice situation to do that, and to be in being in everyday life to use that situation as a practice situation. But it won't catapult you into this realm of freedom where you're totally free to jump off the top of the 100-foot pole. You'll still have the restrictions of the network, the smaller network that you're working in, whatever it happens to be. Basically, in Zen practice, you want to be able to climb and climb and climb, and when you get to the top, you just want to spread out and fly. Yes?
So, this is very interesting to me. I think Suzuki Roshi said something like, you know, you Zen students in America, you're not quite lay people, and you're not quite monastics, priests. And so for 30 years, I've been talking to my teacher, who's always lived in another place, than myself. And at some point early on, he said something to me like, you know, I think you're trying to get something. I said, yeah, I don't know what it is, but I want something. He said, well, try this. Every week, I want you to sweep the sidewalk in front of your house. I want you to sweep the sidewalk next door to yours on both sides. So what if it's raining?
Is that?
I said, what if it's raining?
Uh-huh.
So I want you to sweep the sidewalk. What if my, you know, what's my neighbor going to think? Just try it. Hold on. I don't know. So for some years, I did this. And it was weird, you know? Sidewalk quite as enough, you know? And then every week, I'm on the phone, how's the sweeping going? Well, what about Sandy? He goes, well, tell me about the sweeping. And I said, well, you know, I noticed I didn't want to sweep my neighbors. He's so good, yes. So be careful. You should all sweep everybody the same. So this went on for a long time, but it reminds me of, like, this creative solution.
Yeah, that was when we were on Page Street in San Francisco, the grocers had us take care of that. It was his teaching. It's a very good teaching. It's a very good teaching. It's a very, very clever way of someone that's not there to, like, see where what really your hang-ups are and tweak that one, because looks like you were able to sweep the sidewalk without too much difficulty. It challenged you, but
sometimes,
you
know, I didn't do it.
Yeah, well. You'll have to be reborn as a lower form for sure for that.
But I wonder how that works. Like, in, you know, when you talk about the non-separation between everyday life.
Uh huh.
And, you know, maybe it looks easier if you're in a temple situation or a monastic situation, but.
No, I think everyday life is just sweeping the sidewalk that doesn't belong to you, or whether it belongs to you or not is a very appropriate practice, and it doesn't have to do with whether you're in a. I mean, if you're in a temple, you sweep whether it's, you know, Reb Tai-ins, and my teacher has always said, you know, but we wash because we're already clean. So,
Can you say that again?
We bathe, we wash ourselves because we're already clean. Anyway, so that's sweeping the sidewalk, whether it needs it or not, is a great teaching. But also we need somebody that knows us well enough to know what our real hang-ups are and sticks their finger. I'm having some problems with my body, and my muscles tighten up when I walk, and I can't walk very far, and I've been to all the medical, you know, all the regular medical things, the MRIs, the CAT scans, and the blood testing, and everything. Nothing, they can't find anything wrong, and I'm working with this man now from, he's a Tamil from southern India, who grew up in Tokyo because his parents moved there for work. And he became a reporter, and was doing a piece on these psychic women healers in northern Japan that were part of a Shingon, part of an esoteric Buddhist teaching that went back many centuries. And he got quite fascinated by them, and he ended up coming to California and getting in a PhD program at Stanford and doing a PhD on them in cultural anthropology. And now he's practicing it, and I'm building a center for him. So in exchange for designing the center for him, he's giving me this treatment. Well, this treatment is, first, it's an hour and a half of him finding every sore muscle in my body. And fuck, it's so hard. I mean, it's excruciatingly painful, more painful than hardly anything I've ever experienced before. And I have, you know, a lot of experience with, like, you know, relaxing into pain and being comfortable with pain, but this is just incredible. And then he puts a slice of garlic and a pile of moxa on it and burns it down until it's so hot that you want to scream for another hour and a half. But so that way of finding your sore points and pushing on them, whether it's physical or metaphysical or psychological or sociological, is it's a classic Asian teaching anyway. it's an ancient medicine. But you have to have relationship with a teacher or some sort of a teacher that you trust and that is willing to take you on.
This question of trying to bring the Eastern teaching into the Western world is very interesting to me myself. I'm trying to learn how to do that, especially on Buddhism. And one kind of overarching question is to your point, you know, Western seems to be leaning more nurturing.
Or what?
More nurturing attitude, not this kind of hardcore.
Yeah, yeah, nurturing, you said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how to kind of do that without giving up on diluting the original teaching? One example I can think of is in the Chinese Buddhism practice, we take the five basic precepts, and those are no killing, no stealing, no lying, sexual misconduct, and then no taking intoxicants. When I first took that in Asia, there was no question. Five precepts, just take it. When I came here, even within the Chinese culture, the Buddhism's practice, it started to evolve into this, especially the fifth precept around no taking intoxicants, this lengthy explanation of this is not something you have to take. If you get a social drink, it's okay. If you don't want to take it, you don't have to say it. And then when Q&A comes, inevitably someone's going to ask, can I have a drink and can I have a cup of glass of wine and still not drink this? It's like, it's really amusing to me. Like, so there's a difference in, and then just as an example, I want to try it. Like, anyone is uncomfortable about that? Or maybe that is the point. It's how to kind of evolve it, evolve teaching, whether it's precepts or teachings or any other things within Buddhism, to cater to the Western kind of mindset, but yet not diluting it so much that it loses that.
My understanding of that is that the precepts of that on that level are there to show you that you have leanings in those directions, that you want to drink, that you're liable to tell a story on your neighbor, that you know whatever, you know, and that not doing them is something that you do in the temple under your teacher's supervision, or you do it. You don't do it because it's morally pure, or somehow, the God-given truth. You do them as a practice, and that outside of that, and certainly in Zen, the main precept is not to make two. So if you have this is good and that's bad. If you have this I want to do and that I don't want to do. If you have that kind of understanding already, you've lost the way. So drinking, the most important part about drinking is not being able to drink as well as being able to drink. So you can fall off on either side. But if you're in a training situation, working with a teacher, and he gives you a set of precepts, no matter what they are, following those is the most important thing to do. But they get caught up in thinking that they're somehow, you know, written in stone, that their biblical moral teachings is something that we fall into in the West here quite easily.
So we're, over time, how we usually go Monday night, but also where you had this opportunity to have Paul here and talk with him. But I wanted to, and we will have tea and cookies afterwards and a chance to talk with him. more informally. But you said you wanted to say something about social action, so I wanted to let you say a little bit about that before we stop.
Well, both Tygen and I come from, you know, a political activist background in our younger days, and the, you know, the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin, you know, hears the cries of the world. That's what she does in this world. She hears the cries of the world, and certainly as people that have studied ourselves and have dropped away a certain level of superstition and prejudice, can see and hear the cries of the world quite clearly. I mean, this thing with separating the parents from the children that's happening right now is like major outrageous. But then the question comes up of what to do about it. And that's, from a Buddhist point of view, that's not so clear what to do about it. My feeling about it is that you have to be able to do it in a way that does not make the other side out to be bad, or not turn it into a moral issue, not turn it out to us against them, or these people are, this is what we what real people do, and that's what, you know, ignorant fascistic people do. You have to express your concern in a way that does not create further karmic turbulence. I've been touting this movie that I saw shortly before I came here of First Reform. I don't know how many of you've seen that movie, but anyway, it's a very powerful movie, and it's basically about the evils of global warming. But I don't know that everybody even knows that. I think anybody that sees the movie feels it. It's quite cleverly done. There's no good people and bad people. The good people look kind of screwed up, and the bad people look kind of fun. But it's quite, the overall impact is quite clear that there's something wrong here, and that we all have a moral obligation or an obligation as human beings to do something about it. I found it very, very skillfully done. I don't know, other people may have a different take on it, but because it is a little violent. Anyway, how to raise our voice in a way that makes things better, not just creates more antagonism. Now. Little babies being ripped from their mother, it's pretty hard not to get behind that. Everybody knows that's wrong. But there's a lot of things. I mean, we have to realize that we are, I was going to wear my t-shirt. I have a t-shirt that says, "We are the comet." A friend of mine, an artist friend, made it. I didn't put it on today. I ripped my shirt off. Anyway, you know, us, not just them, but us, are the comet that's destroying the world. You know, because we like our electricity, we like our air conditioning, we like to fly back and forth across the country, we like to eat things that were made thousands of miles away. You know, but we're totally complicit in the disaster that we are living through. So how to protest that, how to do something about that in a way that doesn't, the way that's effective, number one, and a way that doesn't make winners and losers or good guys and bad guys, it's a it's a tricky thing. I have my own little funny things that I like to do, like I don't wear shoes. That's sort of like, you know, depending on, independent of whether it's hot or cold or wet or dry, or, and I like to feel the contact with the earth, and I feel like you can't. There used to be this folk singer named Utah Phillips. I don't know whether some of you know him. And he always traveled with a rubber chicken. And people asked, well, why do you carry that rubber chicken around? He says, well, no one's gonna put me on a pedestal or think I'm really hot stuff if I'm carrying a rubber chicken. So it was a way of keeping humility. So I think that's good. I think finding some way to make sure that I don't see any. I mean, you folks aren't prey to that, but a lot of people are. It's a real question how to affect social change, because really Buddhism just believes that it's delusion, that we all suffer from delusion. It's the cause of suffering, and we are all prey to it. I said that the other day. Suzuki Roshi pointed out to me one time when I was saying, "Oh, this guy is really deluded." He says, "You know, we're all deluded, and we have to accept that and realize that we are all deluded. Reality is not what we think it is. We have our own little story about it. It's a shared story among a lot of us, but it's still a story. And that." I don't know. Maybe the extinction of humans is maybe that's appropriate. Who knows? You know. But whatever we choose to do, we should try to find a way to do it that does not create more karmic turbulence. That's my feeling about it.